adjust it so that, for example, Washington County, which wanted to spend some money in poor, forlorn Eastport, using their TIF money off the wind projects there, were forbidden by order, by opinion from the Attorney General and by apparent precedent in the court system, saying that if you raise taxes, property taxes, in one jurisdiction, they have to be spent largely for the benefit of that jurisdiction and you can't spread them around. The problem we have in the UT is that when you have enormous amounts of tax revenue or TIF money flowing into the hands of the county commissioners and you give them the discretion to spend it only within the unorganized territory, within which development is practically forbidden for all intents and purposes under LURC zoning, you wind up squandering, potentially squandering, the money that we are delivering into their custody and trusteeship. And you can't spend it in places like Jackman, Greenville, Millinocket, Ashland, some of the poorer towns that border onto the UT, who frankly are starved for economic development. And here you have this vision of, my vision is someday driving over Johnson Mountain down into Jackman and having a row of wind turbines up on Johnson Mountain in the unorganized territory, looking down on Addian Lake and Jackman and the Moose River, and having not one nickel of the benefit accrue to the town of Jackman or Moose River. That would be horrible tax policy, and I'm not here to say that necessarily that the wind developers should have to pay any more than they're currently paying. All I'm saying is that we need a system in place. Maybe they should, but there should at least be a system in place whereby the tangible benefits that they are bound to deliver under our tax law, for example, be delivered into communities that need it and that will suffer the consequences of having these machines nearby. So Pete has very cleverly designed a system which he will explain to you, and I think he's already explained it to some people, that would establish a uniform policy of tangible benefits and would give discretion to local political leaders to spend that money in ways more flexibly than we're currently allowed to spend it because of constraints of the Maine Constitution. And I go even further than what Peter has drafted and suggest that when we have these opportunities to enjoy a stream of revenue, whether it be new taxes or TIF money or something in lieu of the TIF, like a community benefit agreement, that we should write statutes that encourage the people that administer those benefits to use them to multiply the impact of them by going to agencies like DECD, to the privately funded trusts that exist in our state, and try to multiply, like the loaves and the fishes, that stream of revenue, match it up with other funds that are available from private and public sources, and create something by way of a meaningful development project or series of projects that are consistent with LURC zoning, consistent with our goals for the unorganized territories and the adjacent municipalities, and that would open up northern and central Maine in ways that were envisioned by the Brookings Report, envisioned by the quality of place studies that you're familiar with, and where we could use this money to catalyze something new and different and interesting for the counties that are adjacent to the unorganized territories and that include the UT. So that's my pitch. I know you're not the BREG committee. I know you're not the Natural Resources Committee. You're the Utilities Committee. But frankly, you folks have the power to wrap it all up and put it together, and that's what this bill invites you to do.
Members of the committee, Representative Mills, Representative Adams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Mills, having attempted to listen and to read at the same time, and knowing that a moment to do both and more depth would be beneficial, by work session, could you attempt to give me your best answer to this query? If the community benefits, how, in what sense, can a package of community benefits in exchange for something given not be thus considered a tax? And how, then, does any entity other than the legislature receiving the tax or the package of benefits thus not, in your proposal, run afoul of that part of the Maine State Constitution which states very bluntly and succinctly that the legislature shall never, under any circumstances whatsoever, relinquish the power of taxation, period? I was turning to try to get that provision out of the Constitution.
You're practically verbatim inciting it, but it is the legislature in this instance that is creating the obligation. So we haven't relinquished it. We're in fact exercising it. And secondly, this isn't to be regarded as a tax. It is a burden, yes. But our statutes are replete with parallel examples. These are mitigation payments. And we do it, the DEP has, for example, enormous power that we have granted to them to require mitigation payments for the loss of wetlands and wildlife refuge and that sort of things when projects go forward. Now, I'm not trying to emulate that, because I think, quite candidly, I think that we have probably granted an awful lot of discretion to the DEP in those settings, and maybe not retained enough directive, not given them enough direction about how to use that power. This would be very similar to the power that we've given to the DEP. It would require, would say, these machines impose a certain burden on the landscape. They deprive adjoining landowners, nearby landowners, of certain discretion and uses over their own property. They have an impact on the landscape, both from a sound production point of view and from a visual impact. And for that reason, there needs to be money paid or some benefit conferred in the form of a mitigation. I think that's the parallel, and that is not, I recognize that it sounds and looks like a tax, but it's a burden that we impose, that we have the right to impose, and the spending of those dollars can be spent without regard, as I see it, without necessarily being confined by the words in the Constitution that have constrained us in regard to tax dollars.
And I hear the thoughtfulness in your reply. Nevertheless, I am concerned about the implication, which is not ours to argue out here. I understand and hear and can follow your reasoning, and yet I, though not being an attorney, can think of two examples where that has not been followed in questions posed to the Attorney General's office about the meaning of that phrase in the Constitution, and other equally, some would say, valid and worthy ideas have run into the wall that it represents.
Yeah.
So having heard your thoughtful answer, and you having heard what I hope to pose as a thoughtful question, can you bring further information to work session about it? You and I are not going to discuss it to a finality today, but it's been very useful.
Well, it is important not to run afoul of it, not to try to spend any time. We shouldn't be spending time on a statute that's going to run afoul of the Constitution. I quite agree with you. I'm reasonably satisfied at first blush that's not an issue, but it's entirely appropriate to raise it and to make sure that it's addressed.
It's the second blush that I worry about.
Yes, of course.
Often it's that blush that gets us into trouble on any number of fields, and I'm going to abandon this line of analogy rapidly. However, we've raised it, we've talked about it, and please bring your best thinking to to the work session where we can explore it further. It may be something this committee should pose as a question, actually. Perhaps you've heard of the Attorney General.
I stay in touch with her from time to time.
Ah, very good. Once again, thank you, Senator Mills.
Without blushing, does anyone have any further questions for the sponsor? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Presentation. Is there anyone else here to testify in support of this bill? Chair recognizes Pete Duduschein.
Representative Hink and members of the Utilities Committee, my name is Pete Diddesheim. I am the Advocacy Director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine. I also served on the Governor's Wind Power Task Force, and I'm here to testify in support of the bill language that has been offered by Senator Mills to replace LD 1504 as introduced. This bill helps bring into focus the benefits of wind power, particularly the economic benefits to host communities, but I'd like to start my remarks speaking a little bit more about the generalized benefits of wind power to the state, as did the sponsor of the language. The committee is well aware of the energy and environmental benefits of wind power. Currently, Maine has 94 utility-scale wind turbines that generate clean, renewable power at Mars Hill, Stetson, Kibbe, Beaver Ridge, Vinyl Haven. These turbines produce power to the grid without burning any fossil fuels. That's important in this day and age. These projects contribute to Maine's energy security by displacing fossil fuels that otherwise would have had to have been used to produce the same electricity. And in so doing, wind power is contributing to the state's efforts to meet our greenhouse gas reduction goals adopted into statute in 2003. And wind power is helping move us away from forms of power generation that are imposing serious security, environmental, and public health impacts on others, and by this, other regions of the planet, and also in terms of future generations. The wind power projects now operating in Maine under construction or having received permits will provide as much electricity on an annual basis as is used by approximately 175,000 households. Details on that are in attachment A to my testimony. This is a considerable amount of power, rivaling the amount generated on an annual basis by Maine's largest hydroelectric dams. Attachment B shows how each of the permitted wind power projects in the white bars rank against some of our largest wind power hydropower facilities. I do that just to give you a sense of the scale of electricity that now is being generated by these turbines. Within 5 years, Maine may generate more electricity annually from the wind blowing across the state than from the water in our rivers. And that's quite a substantial change in where the state's renewable energy will be coming from. The hydropower will continue to be generated, and on top of that, we'll be getting a very significant amount of wind power generation. Wind power also is providing important economic benefits. Nearly 300 businesses have participated in the construction of wind power projects to date, supporting hundreds of Maine workers across the state. There's a map in my testimony that shows the location of all those businesses that have participated in the construction of projects in the state. And construction of each of the major wind power projects has resulted in tens of millions of dollars in spending on materials, labor, and services, providing an economic boost to businesses, communities, and households across the state. These are important benefits, but some of these benefits are fairly abstract, such as enhancing Maine's energy security or meeting our global climate change goals. And some of them are diffuse, such as providing jobs to companies spread across the state. It is also important to understand whether Maine communities that host wind power projects receive tangible benefits for doing so, as was required by the Maine Wind Power Act that was passed in 2008. The evidence so far suggests that they are, but LD 1504 as revised could improve how tangible benefits are provided to host communities. Over the next 20 years, wind developers are expected to provide more than $88 million to seven towns and two counties where operating or permitted wind farms are located. That's attachment D, and it describes the TIF agreements, the taxation payments, the community benefit fund agreements, the payments for electricity that has been negotiated between the developers and those communities. These payments will come in the form of a variety of ways to these host communities, and they're going to be very significant for those communities. One would be hard-pressed to point to any other form of capital investment that would provide this sort of taxation and benefit payments to these communities, largely in rural Maine. But the amounts vary considerably from one host town to the next when put in a standard metric of dollars per megawatt per year. And there's a chart that I have in my testimony that shows each of the different communities in that standard, even for neighboring towns that are part of the same project, as in the case of the Rawlins project that involves four neighboring towns, Lincoln, Lee, Burlington, and Wynn. When the legislature adopted the Maine Wind Energy Act in 2008, it established a new tangible benefit permitting standard for projects in expedited permitting areas. The new standard is important, but was not clearly defined in the statute. As a result, state agencies use guidance document with quite vague descriptions about how a developer can meet that requirement. NRCM believes that there is too much uncertainty and variation when it comes to the tangible benefits provided to host communities, and the amended version of LD 1504 would help solve this problem, while also providing increased flexibility in how such funds could be spent by a host municipality, a host plantation, or a county, such as the example that Senator Mills described, if the project is in the unorganized territory. We support the concept of a legislated standard that would clarify for a host community what they could anticipate in terms of a tangible benefits package. The proposed level of $14,000 per megawatt per year for projects between 20 and 100 megawatts to us seems fair, based on Maine's experience to date. Attachment E shows that the current average for host communities in DEP jurisdiction is just over that amount. Creating a common standard for projects moving forward would be a welcome improvement for communities as they evaluate the costs and benefits of a possible wind power project in their own town or county. A community does lose part of its visual resource in agreeing to host a wind power project. So better upfront knowledge about tangible benefits can help residents and local officials better weigh the costs and benefits of a proposal in their community. It also would help the state of Maine as a whole understand the economic benefits associated with continued development of wind power. Passage of this legislation would mean that every 1,000 megawatts of installed wind power in Maine would provide on the order of $12 million in annual tangible benefits to host communities. These are important benefits above and beyond those related to energy security, climate, lease payments to landowners, and construction and operations jobs. NRCM does not view wind power as a panacea, but we do believe that it is an important part of Maine's energy strategy moving forward. These projects provide significant environmental, often intangible it appears, and economic, which we think can be more tangible, benefits to Maine people, by helping reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and creating clean energy jobs. Passage of this bill would make the benefits for host communities more predictable and more tangible. We urge the committee to use the substitute language as the basis for your work session, and I appreciate this opportunity to testify. We'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Scheim. Are there any questions for this witness from committee members? Representative Fitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious, as you put this together, did you have interface at all with industry to see where they are in this process and whether they agree or disagree with your approach?
I shared the language with the association, the Renewable Energy Association. I had two conversations with one of the leading developers, conversations with three of the other developers. So, and this is over the course of the last week or 10 days. So I think there's been a considerable amount of discussion, and they've had copies of this draft approach for some time, as we've discussed. And the language before you reflects some of the suggestions that came in.
Thank you. And Representative Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the work session.
I can always count on you for some questions for the work session.
Only because if we get into it, we'll be here for hours. Help me think through this cost that's going to be added. What's the likelihood of that flowing through to the price of electricity? which well, I would require some assumption what's on the margin, whether natural gas is on the margin or whether wind power will be on the margin.
For work session, I'll certainly do that. The table that shows that this level of 14,000 per megawatt is above what some communities already have established, a little bit below what others would suggest, that it is capturing our experience to date. So it shouldn't have an effect, but I'll give it some further thought.
Okay.
Are there any other questions for this Representative Van Wee?
For this witness?
I'm harkening back to the earlier
point. He was a witness.
Mr. Dittesheim, I appreciate your testimony. This committee spent quite a bit of time discussing community-based energy at a smaller scale and some of the potential benefits that we were trying to capture at the smaller end of the market. Could you just comment as to sort of how this approach is either consistent with or doesn't obscure or trump our efforts on that scale?
Sure. The threshold for the 14,000 per megawatt per year over a 20-year period would kick in at 20 megawatts. Most of the community wind projects likely are going to be much smaller than that. The Vinyl Haven project is 3 1.5-megawatt turbines, so for a total of 4.5 megawatts. And for the foreseeable future, and based on the legislation you passed, probably the community wind projects are going to be exempt from this. But community wind projects have a different configuration. If they're owned locally, as in the case of the Fox Island Electric Co-op, they are capturing a different benefit package. And those turbines out at Vinyl Haven, as I understand, already are generating 40% more than was projected, and they're immediately translating into lower electricity rates on Vinyl Haven and North Haven, both of which have some of the highest electricity rates in the state. So there's a different approach to how a community might approach a community wind project, and they're thinking about different benefits because they're going to own it, in part or in whole.
Senator Mills also discussed, he discussed the issue of trying to understand how wind could or could not lower electric prices for Maine consumers, which is a very difficult challenge. I'm assuming this really didn't address that concern head on. I mean, his original bill, I think he was trying to grapple with that. I'm just trying to understand kind of how this is consistent with or not consistent with that objective. I think we'd all like to try to find ways to capture some of the when wind is in fact lower, capture some of that benefit for Maine ratepayers. Can you just comment on sort of that relationship? It's not real clear from his discussion and yours or how this substitute bill addresses that issue.
Well, his bill as introduced received quite a substantial level of opposition from developers, from our organization and others who believe that it's difficult, probably impossible, to put that burden on one form of generation, wind power, because there's so many variables in the pricing of electricity. For a developer to be required to lower electricity rates would probably drive investment in wind power away. So in talking with the sponsor, we came up with a different configuration of how to ensure that Maine people are in fact benefiting in a significant and tangible way from wind power moving forward. I do believe that, and I think this is generally the understanding, that wind power does have a dampening impact on upward price pressures because there's no fuel costs for a wind facility. So they are bidding in at zero for the day-ahead market and displacing a more expensive form of electricity generation, which traditionally, generally in this market will be natural gas. So it does mean that there is lower cost energy being added into the mix, but it's still a small enough slice, and it's never going to likely be above 20% of all of ICE in New England, that it's not enough to guarantee reductions in electricity rates.
Do we have any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony and answers.
I think I do.
Representative Fletcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just prompted something. If I go on ISO right now and you look at, you know, the price, with the price of natural gas down, it's 4.5 cents. So if we go with the premise they will bid in at zero and take the clearing, that's the issue I was trying to raise before. Will wind be setting the margin price? Because I don't think they're going to bid in and take four, I think.
Well, I think the margin will always be set by the last unit that's right. Purchased, which will be, you know, something other than wind. Yeah.
You know, if you could just give that a little bit of thought.
Let me give it a
thought. Because, of course, it's all dependent on the price of natural gas.
Yeah.
And right now the price of natural gas is down, lower than it was a year ago, obviously. So if you could just take a look at that, because I think it's going to be so critical from the standpoint of understanding what could be the potential impact and cost of electricity. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, I thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else here today to speak in support of this bill?
Good afternoon. I almost said good morning.
I should have asked for other legislators before.
Oh, actually, I prefer to have Mr. Dinsheim present the bill a little more before I spoke. Senator Hobbins, Representative Hink, and distinguished members of the Utilities and Energy Committee, my name is Diane Russell. I represent District 120 in the main House of Representatives. There's been a lot of technocratic issues that have been brought up, which are very important, but I want to talk to you less about the technicalities of this proposal as reproposed under the modified legislation, and more about some of the experiences that I've had out in the communities, which I think are important as we look at the vision for the state and our philosophy behind where we're moving. Over the summer and the fall, I spent much of my time traveling the state, doing community discussions and speaking with folks around the state. I was up in Aroostook County and Washington County a couple times. I was in Western Maine, Southern Maine, you name it, speaking about clean energy and Maine's opportunities around moving toward a cleaner energy economy. And I was really moved by the excitement that I saw in the eyes of people, regardless of political or generational or geographic backgrounds. People in Maine really understood and understand how critical clean energy is to our future and to our economy. I remember I've spent more than a decade spending time in Washington County because all of my friends are from out there. And every time I go out, the question is, when is the mill going to close? Well, I went out this fall to Machias, and they had put together, the ladies of the area had put together a business expo, a green business expo, and the president of First Wind, Paul Gaynor, came and spoke. I had the opportunity to speak, and I'll tell you that for the first time that I've been out in Washington County, there was not only hope, but a concrete vision for their economy. And I think that, and it was almost entirely tied into the idea of developing a green and clean economy. People were excited at the idea of bringing wind power and tidal power to the region. So the reason I share this with you is that every day I get a set of clips in my inbox all around energy and climate issues, of all the clips that have come through the state. And when I first started out talking to folks about clean energy and energy efficiency, which is my particular strength and passion, the clips were about 85 to 90% in our favor, meaning that folks were, the news was out there talking about clean energy, the clean energy economy in a positive light. And today I was reviewing the clips, and about half the clips were not so nice. the public perception, I'm concerned, may be changing. And the reason I'm particularly interested in this bill is that I think one of the reasons that public perception is changing is that we have so much wind power being developed that people had high expectations that of and false expectations individually about what they were going to get out of it. I can see a homeowner, you know, just assuming that they were going to get a rate decrease because it was in their backyard. They didn't pay too close attention. They weren't at the meetings, but you know how town gossip happens and people chat and they just assume that, that's going to happen. The reason I like this new presentation is that it standardizes what people's expectations are around wind power development. And I think if we see solar power developed or other forms of energy developed, that we should be exploring ways to make certain that that we have a set of standards for those as well. So one of the things that I'm concerned about is that people may assume that they're getting a bunch of outcomes, tangible benefits. When those tangible benefits do not come into fruition, the question, you know, that's when doubt starts stemming into the community, coming into the community. And I'm concerned that some of that doubt is beginning to present itself in the media, and that's our gauge for public perception. And moving forward, I think that standardizing what people's expectations are will not only make it easier for developers to understand what to expect in their costs, but I think it'll make it easier for municipalities and regions to make better decisions about whether this is a good choice for them or not. You know, we all have our benchmark people, our people that are sort of our bellwether folks about what's going on, and my mom is one of those bellwethers. And back in my hometown in Bryant Pond, they are considering a small wind turbine farm, which is only 3 turbines, so it will not meet this threshold. But some of the very same questions are coming up. Well, what are we getting out of this? You know, what is a benefit to our community? Is it, are we going to get a lower rate? Are we going to get a new ball field? What are we going to get, and how do you define that? And so as you look at these larger farms, those questions are exponentially more important. Making anything that we can do to clarify the language, to standardize the process, I think we're going to be in a better position long-term to attract new development and to make certain that our communities that bring in those new wind power developments are in a better position to support things, because there's no ambiguity, there's no vagary around what people expect out of the development. So I think I'm just advocating in general that this is a good principle. I'm not going to go toe-to-toe with any of you on the technocratic details, because that's not my strength. I admit where my strengths are. However, the principle behind standardizing this, I think, is going to go a long way toward preserving public perception about this long-term vision that I think that many of us here in the legislature and certainly around the state share. I would like to see every region of the state have opportunities for economic growth and to reduce our carbon output, and also to really just become less dependent. I mean, when you think about it, every time you fill up your car, you're funding both sides of the war. So any opportunity that we have to be able to reduce that paradigm is a good thing. So I want to take up no more of your time, and thank you. Speaking.
Thank you, Representative Russell. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Van Wien.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Russell. I just want to ask a question, since you're at the podium. This is sort of a general question for all, but I've expressed this already to a few. And I generally support the concept here. I think it's a real good run at the issue. It runs up against sort of a general a principle that I have, which is I don't usually like to see dollar signs, like a particular number, $14,000 or whatever, in law, without some mechanism to allow us to adjust that or change it.
I brought up that same point this morning.
Or you know, that by setting a standard, that's great, but you know, the free market people would say, well, what if suddenly people decide that they want
$30,000, and somebody's willing to pay that, but we've just let them off the hook for $14,000. So I'd like to get a little bit of a further discussion of that at the work session, and if you have any thoughts on that, or if others have put thought into it, please offer that at the work session, and if you have any comments.
I am only going to speak, obviously, for myself, so please don't misunderstand that the sponsor or anybody else shares this thought. I have the same exact question this morning. How do you put a mechanism in place that allows that to increase? And perhaps the answer isn't a dollar symbol. Perhaps it's some sort of a calculation that can be put into statute. But I think that I'm not really convinced that it has to be a dollar number, or that it has to be specifically a formula, but I think that we need significantly better clarity in what that tangible benefit is. I support what NRCM proposed, but I think that if there are other options that can be put on the table, and I would certainly want Mr. Dittesheim and Senator Mills to answer in their own respect, but I just want to clarify tangible benefit.
I was taking the opportunity to ask while you were here.
Yes, no, I appreciate that.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Are there others who would like to speak in favor of LB 1504 in its amended version? Good afternoon, Mr. Davis.
Senator Hobbins, Representative Hinkin, members of the Utilities and Energy Committee. I'm Dick Davies. I'm here in support. You have my written testimony, and I would comment a little bit on that testimony. You'll notice that I've said that I'm in qualified support for the original version of the bill as written, and stronger support in the amended version of it. And the next two paragraphs were really written before I saw the amended version of the bill, and it wrestled with the same issue that Senator Mills and other people who have spoken today have been wrestling with. How do you quantify these sort of things? How do you try and ensure that wind power is going to have a positive effect on the price of electricity? I must say that I have some concern in trying to put into statute that wind power development is going to reduce the price of electricity for a lot of reasons, one of which has already been mentioned, that it's going to be a relatively small portion of the total quantity of power being generated, and its ability to single-handedly lower the price of electricity against the force of energy prices rising and others suggests that putting language in there really needs to be qualified or written in some different fashion. Clearly, there are a lot of forces that it's going to be struggling against in order to achieve some reduction in the price of electricity, which is why when I saw the proposal that Senator Mills presented today and had a chance to talk with Pete Dittesheim about it, it really crystallized in my mind that this was a more rational way of approaching the problem, and that while it may not be a perfect solution, it goes a long way towards addressing some of the uncertainty that lies out there and helps avoid the problem that occurs when perhaps one community is more effective in negotiating with a potential developer and another is not. I think that it goes about addressing that. It also begins addressing one of the problems that we've been hearing about for the last couple of months of some concern about wind development in general. And while much of that concern, I think, that's being expressed about wind development appears to be coming from residents of communities who are being affected by this, and some of them are simply opposed to wind in general, and even if the wind project were 200 miles away from their home, they might still be in opposition to it. But there are a lot of folks who express concerns, in part because they want to know what are we getting back in return for this deal. It's very clear what the developer would be getting, the ability to build a project that has a potential over a long period of time to generate the developer a very sizable amount of money, even in the face of the very high financing costs that they face. It's a little bit more nebulous about the host community and what they're going to get out of that. And while some of what Pete Dittesheim showed you indicates that some communities have been doing quite well at negotiating those sort of deals, I think being able to assure all communities are going to get some fair return for what they are giving up is an important development, and I think that this is a very useful way of approaching the problem and would support it very strongly. And I can say that I passed along the idea to the governor the other day after having a chance to talk with Pete Dittishine. And the feedback I got from a member of his staff earlier today was the governor was very interested in the idea, liked it a great deal. So one more endorsement in support of the idea. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Representative Fletcher.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the work session. And you've been through this 100 times today. If we impose a fee of $14,000 per meg, what are the possibilities of getting that back to the consumer to lower their cost of electricity? You know, how could we do that if, in fact, that is something we wanted to do?
I think clearly one way that we've already seen a little bit of development on, and I hope we're going to see some more in the very near future. In fact, the Commission may be even deliberating a second long-term contract today as we speak. The long-term contracts have the ability to have an arm's-length negotiation between the Commission staff and the developers to come up with something that's beneficial to both sides. The project that we saw that First Wind proposed has a good possibility, and the Commission did accept that. That's one way that you can provide some assurance that over the long term that there is going to be some lesser price for that energy than otherwise would be paying. But as I indicated, it's dicey because that small drop in the bucket has to offset a lot of other big drops that may be going in the opposite direction. And so we need to find ways to encourage even more developers to use long-term contracts and maybe develop some other tools that were discussed in previous sessions with the committee but not accepted, and maybe time to go back and revisit some of those ideas to see if we can build an array of things in addition to the host community benefits that provide real and measurable benefits in the long term.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, and which is leading me to this long-term contracting idea, how does that mesh into 14,000 equivalent? And here's the gist of the question. If you negotiate a long-term contract, that's got pluses and minuses both to the generator as well as anything else. So if we've got a standard fee that's the benefit to the community, how do we integrate that into the long-term contracting approach, which gets at the whole issue of how much the generator is going to give up, so to speak?
It's a very good question, and I don't have an answer. And I'm not sure I'm going to have one at the work session, but I'll give it some thought.
I'm sure you will.
Davies, thank you very
Senator,
much.
Thank you.
Others would like to speak in favor of LD 1504 at this time.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Senator Hobbins, Chair Hank, and members of the committee. My name is Sean Mahoney. I'm with the Conservation Law Foundation. And I'm testifying in support of the proposed substitute language. I guess the first thing I'd want to say is, with respect to wind power, which we at CLF have been a supporter of for a number of years, wind power will eventually decrease the cost of electricity across the board for ratepayers, especially when we begin to price electricity to include not just the cost of acquiring the fuel, but also the impacts associated with the fuel sources we use. And that the, as a general matter, tangible benefits for host communities for any sort of project is a concept that we would support, and one that shouldn't just be limited to renewable energy projects, and particularly wind power projects. The Representative Adams and Representative Fitz and you, Senator Hobbins, know from our work together on the Ocean Energy Task Force, one of the key recommendations for developing offshore energy is to make sure that there is a community participation and buy-in in whatever sort of projects we have, and really having something that's tangible and palpable for communities to see as benefiting their community. And we think that this revised proposal makes some good steps in doing that, particularly the idea of standardizing what the tangible benefits would be across Maine communities within the state. We do see variations of it, and having one standard proposed, one standard, I think is a fair and readily understood way of going about that. I think we all share the common goal of developing the wind resource in the state. What we don't want to do is create a legal regime that's not flexible. And I think that the comments that you raised, Representative Van Wee, in speaking with Representative Russell, is an important one to address during the work session, and we look forward to doing that. I think that the at the end of the day, the need for the vast majority of Maine people who support developing renewable energy needs to have a tangible reason for it, other than it's a good action to take to address global warming. And I think that having a tangible benefit like we're talking about here is a way to do that. So we're in support of the bill and look forward to the work session on it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to testify in favor of LB 1504 today. Is there anyone present who would like to speak in opposition to this proposal? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator Hobbins, Representative Hink, members of Joint Standing Committee on Utilities and Energy. My name is John Cooney. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Development for Reed & Reed. We are a general construction firm that's headquartered in Woolwich, Maine. I reside in Brunswick. I'm here to testify in opposition of LD 1504. I have prepared some comments which are being distributed presently. I'm going to summarize the slides that I have. The first three slides I like to call wind power by the numbers. 2020, 3,000, 2.5, and $7.5 billion. 2020 is the year established by the governor's task force to install 3,000 megawatts and reduce carbon emissions by 10%, as Peter Didesheim has already mentioned. The 2.5 is the approximate cost per megawatt to install wind energy in the state of Maine. And $7.5 billion represents the total capital investment required to achieve the targets established by the legislature. I'd like to spend a few minutes going over the capital investment overview. The capital investments on these projects are significant, and they translate into tangible economic benefits without question. The development cost, engineering and design cost, turbine procurement, transmission, interconnect facilities, roads, turbine foundations, the turbine installation and erection, the electrical works, collector system, substations, transmission lines, operations, maintenance facilities. The balance of plant investment are the types of cost for the project, excluding owner development, turbine procurement, operations, and maintenance cost. Typically, those are the types of cost.
What's it all about, LB?
Reed & Reed brings to the table when we perform this business activity in the state of Maine. On all the projects that we've done to date, there's been significant benefit to vendors and suppliers within the state of Maine. Concrete supply, electric materials, reinforcing steel, steel fabrications, fuel, lumber supplies, There are also a lot of jobs during construction. Those jobs are varied and they're high paying. The jobs include managers, skilled engineers, surveyors, technicians, operators, carpenters, millwrights, laborers, riggers, electricians, and other types of specialists. And every project that we've performed to date, there's been significant involvement and benefit to the local businesses of these committees, these communities. And I've listed several of them. But I also go to these projects on a weekly and biweekly basis. And whenever I stop at the gas station, or if I stay at the hotel up to Sugarloaf because we have a meeting the next day, I'm always asking the people in the local community, or if you go to the store, or you go get lunch, what their perspective on these projects are. And I rarely have heard an indication that there's a feeling of lack of economic benefit in their community. Specifically to Kibbe, we did a study and we report monthly. To date, we've been on that job a year, and we've determined that over $10 million just of our budget have been spent within 25 miles of the project. Maybe it's 35, but if you go to Kibbe and you draw a radius to Stratton and Eustace and Sugarloaf, it's significant money that's directly gone to the vendors and members of the community. In terms of construction jobs and payroll, we're in a strong position to advise what the economic impact is of these construction jobs. There's actually a typo on the construction jobs and payroll page. I apologize for that. The analysis that we've done, we've actually discussed this with Charlie Colgan, is about $288,000 per megawatt installed, just of construction wages. Now, if you take the 3,000 megawatts times the $288,000, that's $864 million of wages, and over 95% of those construction wages go to Maine employees. The wages are high. On average, in total, it's about $31 an hour. All these jobs have benefits, health insurance, retirement, vacation, holiday. There are full-time jobs created by these projects. There are operations and maintenance positions created by the owners of the jobs. But what's also happening is as the turbine generators are populated in the Northeast, there's a side impact in terms of the maintenance and operations. So, for example, Reed is a certified maintenance contractor with General Electric. We're also working to make a similar arrangement for Vestas and Siemens, and these are all turbine suppliers. And as they put their units up in the Northeast, they need regular and significant maintenance that requires skilled technicians and the heavy equipment that we've invested approximately $20 million in over the last 2.5 years. I have a slide that summarizes the economic impact in Maine. The balance of plant work typically represents 40 to 50% of the total project cost. The Kibbe project is, for example, I've heard $375 million. If you have 45% of $7.5 billion, that's $3.375 billion of direct economic impact, notwithstanding the multiplier of these projects in the state of Maine. And I also just mentioned the maintenance work that's becoming a separate market, wind farm operations and maintenance. And we're also leveraging federal tax dollars that are coming to Maine by these projects. There are also property tax revenues that are significant. There are also sales tax revenues that are very significant because I happen to be undergoing a sales and use tax audit, and I'm also part of, there's been a determination letter request by one of our clients, and we're really trying to figure out the taxability of the infrastructure of these projects, and at least at the initial outset, that there's significant tax dollars that are going to be assessed on the infrastructure of these projects. So again, that's another indication of the tangible economic benefit of this the wind energy. In conclusion, Maine should roll out the Welcome Mat for wind power. The benefits of wind energy projects are environmental and economic. LD 1504 is not necessary. Please do not tinker with the language. And if 1504 is not a tax, it is a handout that will ultimately be reflected in higher rates. When I went to school, we had a class, economics, and one of the first things the economics professor wrote on the wall that there are no free lunches. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions at all?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I have a question as to whether you're opposed to the original language of the bill or to the replacement language of the bill.
That's a good question. I haven't really studied Peter's version of the bill, so I'm going to reserve a little bit of comment. I think that our clients, these projects are financial transactions, and when they price financial risk, if they can eliminate certainty, it's helpful. So any resolution that addresses that requirement for them to proceed and underwrite a project is helpful. But I can tell you right now that the wind energy is not healthy. It is still reeling from the economic crisis that we all are living today. And these projects are highly leveraged. And with the failure of Lehman Brothers and some several syndicates in Europe, that the finance, that the takeout financing from these projects disappeared overnight. And they haven't come back yet. And also on top of that, with the economic crisis, that tax increment financing required for these financial transactions to work, there's no market for that tax benefit.
I guess I have another question. I appreciate your presentation. I'm trying to look a little beyond just the construction phase. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the construction phase is a huge industry, and there's huge dollars involved. And I'd just like to ask you for your reflection a little bit. Once you get beyond the construction phase, obviously, Senator Mills was asking some questions as to what are not only the short-term, but some of the long-term benefits to Maine. And we've as a committee, struggled with the issue, as you heard a few minutes ago, how do we capture some of the rate benefits because of the way the contracts are structured. A lot of the value of the wind gets priced at, in fact, natural gas and goes to other people, not to Maine ratepayers. It goes to owners of the project or Wall Street bankers or owners of the turbines or whomever. So part of, I guess, I'm asking is, have you thought about beyond the construction phase and the fact that there's a social contract? The analogy I come up with is hydropower, which was a good one. You know, those were licensed in a way for 50 years, 40 years, 30 years. They were constructed. It was a public resource. We're addressing that same kind of an issue now, where the dams were built many years ago for great reason. We needed electricity for hospitals and all these other things. But because they were licensed over a period of time, there was an opportunity for society to renegotiate the contract with the owner of that dam somewhere down the road, which we've just been going through that process.
think the struggle here, and I'm interested in your thoughts, is we're trying to figure out how to look at wind power not just as a construction project, but as a contract over the life of that project for the local residents and the ratepayers and the taxpayers of the state of Maine. And how do you better allocate benefits and costs over time once the construction phase is gone? And you folks are obviously in the construction business. You don't want barriers to that. Neither do we. We want more wind projects. But I think the nature of Senator Mills' question, and it was an excellent one, is how do we capture that contract with the owners of that project over the lifetime? That's what I'm struggling with. And property taxes, I think in his conclusion, the property tax, the mill rate going to that local town, maybe isn't enough. Maybe it's not the best mechanism, and we're trying to come up with another mechanism for how to capture some of the impacts and benefits that will accrue to or be suffered by people in the region after the construction phase is gone. Have you guys struggled with that? I mean, that's different, and I know it's going a little bit out of your realm. I'm just curious as to see what your reflection might be as we get beyond that construction phase.
Well, there were elements of my presentation that dealt with the construction jobs, because I do think those are important. But there are also elements that don't. And the $7.5 billion in capital investment is something that creates tangible personal property. You know, it's tangible property that's built in the state of Maine, and we have mechanisms in place in the state of Maine to tax that property, the income generated from that property, and this is a very immature industry. I think it's going to play out over time, but I tried to focus my presentation on the magnitude of that capital investment, because as I sit here today, and yes, I do work for a construction firm, but I also live in Brunswick, Maine. I'm a taxpayer. I've been here for a long time, and we want what's best for our state, and I don't see a lot of options. I don't see mills coming in and putting a $5 billion pulp and paper plant. So we have to try to encourage capital investment and realize the benefits that come with that. Now, they may not be everything that another type of capital investment has, but I don't believe that should restrain us from not encouraging that capital investment, because frankly, if I actually saw a lot of emails, because this isn't the first time there's been a question about what does tangible economic benefit mean to the state of Maine, and that question's been out there for a long time. And when Lurk read that statute, I think they struggled in terms of what does that mean, and they sent a lot of emails out to agencies that they felt were stakeholders, and I've actually seen a lot of those responses, and you wouldn't believe what they received from all the different agencies as it related to their interpretation of what tangible economic benefit could mean to them. You know, one agency was like, well, we can have a green jobs fund, so we should make them put money in that. And, you know, another agency says, well, geez, you know, we need money too, and we should ask them to put money here. So I think that concept is a challenge for the state. I think the process is going to be played out, but I just want to remind people that it's a fragile industry, and sophisticated owners and developers can very easily put these projects somewhere else, and I think that we need to be very careful of how we change our policy so that we do not disrupt the flow of capital to the state of Maine, because that in itself is a permanent, tangible economic benefit.
Thank you very much for your comments. Is there anyone else who would like to speak in opposition to this? Good afternoon, Mr. O'Neill.
Senator Hobbins, members of the committee, Chris O'Neill from the city of Saco. I'm here to represent Friends of Maine Mountains, initially in support of the bill as drafted, but I discarded my prepared remarks to respond to the bill as amended. So I'm now here in opposition. The Friends of Maine's Mountains is a group of folks who are both mountain dwellers and flatlanders who oppose the proliferation of wind power development, especially on Maine's mountains, not based on NIMBY, but on NIM, which is not in Maine. The Friends of Maine's Mountains holds highly the treasure and value that Maine's landscape affords to us as Mainers. And as pointed out in Charting Maine's Future, known in the vernacular as the Brookings Report, Maine's quality of place. In exchange for what we consider to be the desecration, degradation, devaluation, and destruction of our habitat for, or in exchange for, what we deem to be an unreliable, unaffordable, and unsustainable experiment. That said, in response to Senator Mills' amendment, very well thought out amendment, we point out to you that it presupposes several things. One, that Maine will indeed stay this new and potentially treacherous course toward being a power plantation in a gold rush mentality. Two, that the glowing projections of tangible benefits that have been expounded to you today actually have veracity. Three, that the mitigation payments, or impact fees, if you want to call them that, will come from, and this is an important one, that those payments will come from someplace other than your pocket and mine as taxpayers and ratepayers. Four, presupposes that there will actually be customers for the product that this proliferation will create. I say that just to remind you of our neighbors to the north at Lower Churchill, New Brunswick, and Hydro-Quebec, who are producing renewable power. Hydro-Quebec, 93% renewable portfolio at production costs in the single pennies. Five, it presupposes that Maine's quality of place is not so important. It's not as important as we all thought, but that it is indeed for sale for a named price.
40 days.
Six, the proposal presupposes that the established permitting standards and requirements, those that lurk in DEP and municipalities,
40 days,
now use in vetting applicants, will be diminished by virtue of the fact that this new standard becomes codified and indeed legitimized. When I say legitimized, I just ask you, let's take a situation where you might have
40 days! Woo-hoo!
It comes to a town like, let's say, Oakfield or Dixmont. One community's approach to a project might be radically different from another community's approach. And one has to ask whether the legislature should usurp that sovereign right of local control by prescribing price tag numbers on various community benefits. What if the community seeks more as compensation? What if a community simply refuses, yet the applicant says, but we're prepared to pay what the statute says we need to pay? Again, I commend Senator Mills and those who rolled up their sleeves to do what my group initially wanted to support, which was to ensure that Maine isn't just a power plantation being sucked dry to our friends in Boston and Hartford and elsewhere for no tangible benefit in Maine. We thought that as long as Maine is hurtling headlong into this what we perceive to be shallow gold rush pool, that we ought to get something. But it would have been very little, even at that, if it could have been reflected in lower rates. But absent that, we see the proposal as being very easy to oppose. Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill, I'm glad you're here today, and you've certainly enlightened me a bit into the world of the lobby and how hard your job can be sometimes. But I appreciate that you have a client and that you have to bring your client's position forward. But I can't believe that you believe it. That's my opinion.
Is that a question?
It will be. Because as I listened to you talk, I started to try to pick through it all and get down to the base of, well, what is it you do want? What is it that you think is the solution to the problem? And I think what I got from what you said was that Canada is going to fix our problem. Is that right?
No.
So what is going to fix our problem? The fact, and the problem, I'll frame it for you.
Please, articulate
the problem. The problem is that we have a region, not just a state, but a region that is over-dependent on fossil fuel, that is at the mercy of a market that we have no control over. And we have nothing to fill that gap if that market dries up. So what is your fix?
Well, if we assume, Representative Fitz, that we convert to a plug-in society, then perhaps electrification of Maine does get us off fossil fuel. But that's all conjecture at this point. In answer to your question, my group actually espouses, A, the fact that we produce far more power today than we need in Maine, and we are a net exporter. Two, that we are a very high renewable power generator. Three, the neighbors to our north provide some piece of a solution to lower cost power and perhaps greener, quote-unquote, power. But beyond that, what one of the positions that my group espouses is that if one could take
40 days, woohoo,
in the form of ratepayer and taxpayer subsidies that are going to the construction projects and the developers, and you've heard this low-hanging fruit argument, I'm sure, and instead divert some, maybe not even all of it, but some portion of it toward putting Maine people to work in every community, weatherizing, efficiency, conservation, to a much higher degree than what you saw last week with the bill LD 1222 and the others, where we're finding that the incentives that are created now aren't really drawing people out of the woodwork. As Representative Fletcher opined, that the incentives need to be meaty enough to actually attract people to make the investment to get the benefit. So in five parts, I think that's my answer. And in response to you, I actually find that lobbying's easy on some days, not so easy on others, but it's a job, and it's not what I've always done. I come from a business background. I happen to back into lobbying, and I like it because I get to deal with really imaginative, good, challenging folks like yourself, and I like that. But I will tell you this. I once, my views are, nobody's paying me to tell you what my views are, but since you asked, I remember saying, and if you might, you recall, I was a legislator once. I actually sponsored a bill way back in the 1990s that would have laid the groundwork for more proliferation of wind power. I firmly believed it was the way to go. I firmly believed it was all good and not bad. I personally, just for your edification, believe every word I said today.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Neill. Just for public disclosure, Mr. O'Neill is one of my constituents. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chairman Hobbins, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Payne. I'm the executive director of the Maine Renewable Energy Association, formerly known as the Independent Energy Producers of Maine. We changed our names in September, just so you know. We're a not-for-profit association of renewable power producers, suppliers of goods and services to those producers, and other supporters of the industry. My members manufacture electricity in a sustainable manner from hydro, biomass, wind, tidal, and waste energy. We're opposed to LD 1504 as drafted for a number of reasons, but as we all know, there is new language that was suggested by the NRCM and Senator Mills. Unfortunately, I didn't receive this language until Thursday night, and thus my members and I have not had sufficient time to review and analyze the substantial changes proposed. So for that reason, my testimony will focus on the original language from Senator Mills. So we have basically five specific concerns with the bill around two basic questions. What are we trying to fix and why? First, the language contained in the tangible benefit statute was intentionally left vague to give prospective wind developers the greatest ability to offer creative and flexible host community benefits for their projects. The needs of Town A may differ greatly from Town B. We believe local communities are more than capable of assessing their own needs and question why it appears this bill proposes that those decisions should reside in Augusta. Number two, the language of the bill says the applicant would be required to, quote, provide a tangible benefit to ratepayers in the state in the form of a reduction in long-term electric rates. Does this mean we're asking wind companies to predict future electric rates and then, based on their own internal analysis, offer a discount? How do we know what the future rates will be and what happens if they're not predicted accurately? Who is then responsible for that number? Wind power pricing, and all generation for that matter, should continue to be dictated by the marketplace. Number three, furthermore, why is the industry being singled out and mandated to provide a discount on their product to Maine citizens? Wind companies sustainably manufacture electricity, and we neglect to see what makes them unique and that they should be singled out and mandated to provide their product at a discount. Do we saddle other Maine-based industries or developments with the same requirements? If Walmart expands a store to include a lawn and garden section, are the mulch, grass seed, rakes, and lawnmowers sold at a discount to Maine citizens? Do we ask lawyers, potato farmers, blueberry growers, milk farmers, microbreweries, or even paper companies to offer their services or products at a discount? No, of course we don't. And we shouldn't treat wind companies any differently, less fairly, or more uniquely. Number four, if we include projects currently under construction, Stetson 2 and the second half of the Kibbe project, we're now just north of 13% of the way toward our wind power goals of 2,000 megawatts by 2015. The more often we put up speed bumps, or in the case of this bill, roadblocks, the less likely we are to meet or exceed those goals. We have a tremendous opportunity to cultivate and support a rolling renewable economy, which allows the companies who have been involved in the construction of these projects, and you've just heard from one, to move from wind project to wind project, creating clean, green, renewable power to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions
and lower Maine's over-reliance on fossil fuels. But if we put up unnecessary and onerous regulations in place, we're potentially threatening the future prosperity for wind and other renewable development in Maine. Number five, the bill's language is also very unclear on how the long-term electric rates would be reduced for ratepayers. Is the aim to reduce rates for just the host community or for everybody? What if a company makes an arrangement to sell their power, to sell their energy through a power purchase agreement to Bowdoin College, the University of Maine, or another large energy consumer, or as you also heard earlier questioned by Representative Fletcher, through a long-term contract? Are they still required to provide rate cuts to other ratepayers? No matter what the answer is, the requirement is still unnecessary and infeasible. Overall, we believe the existing language in the tangible benefits statute currently provides tremendous economic benefits to the people of Maine through jobs, economic investment, environmental attributes, and price-taking generation. We're opposed to 1504, and I'd be happy to take any of your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pan. I believe Representative Flaherty has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for coming today, and congratulations on the new name, even more ambiguous than it was before. I'm having trouble, and I'd love for you to expand on the fact with your third argument that why are we singling out wind? And I guess the comparison to Walmart is just so troubling for me, because Walmart doesn't go up 100 feet into the sky, produce incredible noise and wind changes to our environment, not incredible noise, but to its neighbors, does not provide a resource for a regulated utility in this state, and more importantly, I guess, has what I would consider considerable public issues. Call them NIMBY, you call them what they want, but I guess I'm having trouble figuring out why we shouldn't be singling out wind. Why we shouldn't be saying that we are making public investment, and in many cases these wind projects are on formerly public land or are being heavily subsidized, oftentimes, some of the smaller ones, by public entities, whether it be a town or even necessarily incentives from states or public-private partnerships. I guess I have a lot of difficulty with how we're not somehow tasked on this committee, in this body, with having some say over something like wind towers and giant wind farms. Now, I'm not opposed to wind. I had as much trouble with the previous speaker as anybody. And I think that we're moving the right direction in the state. But I also don't think it is, by any means, unorthodox for us to expect that when we make considerable public investment, that one, we can guarantee a rate of return. I mean, in this state, we guarantee insurance companies a profit. Why can't we guarantee ourselves as ratepayers a small profit if we're going to be going above and beyond, which I think rightfully so, to encourage the development of wind in this state?
Let's start first with the Walmart issue. Maybe a bad comparison, but the point I was trying to make is there are certainly those on the coast within the past few years who have had a lot of problems with Walmarts to the point where they're enacting their own ordinances. So that was one of the reasons I was citing that as an example. I guess I disagree with you that you're not getting a return on your investment. I mean, you're seeing property tax rates go down. You're seeing good-paying jobs created. You're seeing the opportunity for a rolling renewable economy. You're seeing greenhouse gas emissions reduced. You're seeing natural gas or other fossil fuels being taken off and then having wind power replace it. I view those as benefits. Whether there's something you expect beyond that, you know, Representative, I'm not sure. I view those as a taxpayer in this state and a ratepayer to my utility as a tangible benefit that I'm more than comfortable paying for and, as to use your word, subsidizing.
Thank you for that. And I'm trying to make the Walmart example work, so I'm not holding that against you. I guess I just, as somebody who currently pays for renewable energy, I subscribe to the Light and Power interfaith wind power. I pay more on my electric bill because I want to encourage, it's a market decision that I'm making to encourage. I guess that decision, along with any actions that I take in the time that I have here, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect in 20 years that we're paying less than 12 cents a kilowatt. I don't think that's unreasonable, that when we're building these wind farms with all the other benefits that I completely agree with and that I'm here for, but those are immediate benefits. And we're here using organizations like the Maine Renewable Energy Association and other stakeholders in an effort to bring down energy costs to help improve the economy. This is not just concrete and sand and gravel that we're looking to get out of these wind farms and a couple of jobs and maintenance. I don't think it's unreasonable for us to expect that we have a lower rate of electricity as a result of these significant investments that we're making, and in some people's case, significant, giving up significant valuable land in the mountain cases and offshore territory in many of the cases. Why doesn't your organization, the Maine Renewable Energy Association, seek to reduce energy costs over a 20-year period? And wouldn't that benefit by having renewable energy prove cheaper, the overall use of renewable energy in this state?
Well, as I think you heard from an earlier speaker, this is, you know, an industry that's just gaining a foothold in the state. So to expect an immediate drop in electric rates is, I think, unrealistic. I mean, okay, even still, I mean, you have the fossil fuel industry has been receiving subsidies for 50 or 60 years. So I think you need to, I would ask for patience. It's not something I think I can tell you by X date it's going to be X percent lower. I just feel like there's an unrealistic expectation that wind is the silver bullet. It's not. It's one piece of the puzzle. You know, we're also making other policy decisions in this state. You know, is it important enough to pay a premium to have clean, green, renewable power? I think we have said yes. That does come with a cost. But that doesn't mean that it should, you know, be a, I don't think that the ratepayers are losing because of it. I think that, you know, getting back to my fossil fuel point, we're used to paying those subsidies. We're familiar with them. They've been going on for 50-plus years. It's something that is not a big deal to us anymore. Wind subsidy is because it's new. So it's getting a focus.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11, 12.
Thank you very much. Three, four, five. Anyone else who would like to speak? Officer Representative
Wagner.
14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. That this would be applicable to projects currently under construction. Wouldn't this still be prospective that those are in the pipeline right now? This would not be applicable to?
Correct. My point was just to give us sort of a reality check. Here's where we are. We're 13% of the way towards our policy goal, and we're already talking about making a substantial change to the statute. So be careful. It's not as though we're 90% of the way there and we're trying to make a very narrow tweak that will help us bring the, you know, the other 10%. We're a long way away. And when you start making changes and create uncertainty, developers get nervous and start looking at other states.
Speaking of perspective, not doing anything expensive.
Correctly. That's my understanding.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much. Also, let's take an opposition. Good afternoon. Long afternoon.
Good afternoon, Senator. Senator Hobbins and Representative Hink and members of the committee, appreciate very much the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. The clerk is distributing copies of the testimony, so in the interest of everyone's stomach and safe driving and so forth, I'll try to summarize the testimony and be happy to try to entertain any questions you may have. My name is Cleve Kapala. I'm the Director of Government Affairs and Relicensing for TransCanada in the U.S. Northeast region. My office is in Concord, New Hampshire, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this bill. There's a couple of paragraphs on background of who TransCanada is and what we do here in New England. I won't go into a lot of detail, but we do have hydroelectric plants in New Hampshire, Vermont, and in Massachusetts. And we also have a natural gas plant in Rhode Island, and we also operate and are a partial owner of the PNGTS gas transportation system. We think a leader in North American energy infrastructure. Our corporate office is in Calgary, Alberta. The reason we're here and paying attention to this bill this afternoon is we also have permitted the Kibby Wind Project, and the first phase of the Kibby Wind Project went online this past fall, and we're looking forward to putting phase two of the project online in mid to late 2010. Although we've been in Maine for a while with the PNGTS system, we're very proud to be part of the renewable energy community in Maine and to be supporting the goals of Maine to increase its renewable profile. We think it's a good move by the state of Maine, and we appreciate the treatment we've received in Maine since we've been here. I'd like to talk a little bit now about particularly about tangible benefits and how we feel that we have addressed these issues to date since we've been in Maine. There are some summary issues and some numbers in my testimony, but we believe that the Kibby Project has provided tangible benefits, and certainly my experience in the Euston-Stratton area and also in other areas in Maine, as we talked about the Kibby Wind Project, we feel people are satisfied and appreciate what we've done. We also note that 90% of the of people polled in Maine support wind power, that it does seem to be something that people feel is a part of the future for this state, and the fact that you're an exporter of wind is probably to your advantage. I would not trade where you are for Massachusetts or Connecticut at this point. I think you're in a good position. Speaking again of the tangible benefits, particularly we've made specific efforts, and they were alluded to earlier by the gentleman from Reed and Reed, to interface with the community in Eustis and Stratton and work with them to design a custom package. It's not a standardized package. We think it was responsive to the particular needs of that community, and we feel that it has done good things already, and we look forward to it doing many good things in the next 20 years, which is the expected life of the Kibby Project. To numbers, we expect to spend about $360 million for Kibby in the build-out of phases one and two. As of the end of October, we had spent approximately $7.3 million locally in the Eustis and Stratton region, which is that's mainly procurement of services, restaurant meals, hotel rooms, things like that, and also all of the other support things that are needed by a project that don't come in on flatbed trucks or can be procured locally. We've also spent approximately $81 million, which is the contractor and subcontractor payrolls, and peak construction activity has supported approximately 300 workers, 95% of them actually were recruited and hired in Maine, and the long-term maintenance and operations hiring is not complete now, but to date we have retained 8 positions, and all of them are folks that live here in Maine. The other thing, and there's been a lot of talk about the pricing, and certainly we think that introducing wind does have a positive effect on rates in Maine and elsewhere in New England. When wind is operating, it's providing, as a prior witness testified, it's bid in at zero, and it is displacing generally a fossil fuel, and that does help to lower prices. I'm moving now to the fourth page of my testimony. With respect to this particular committee's oversight, most of my testimony is oriented toward the original bill submitted by Senator Mills. I haven't had a lot of opportunity to look at Mr. Dittesheim's amendment or his replacement bill. But generally, we feel that the tangible benefits that Kibby has provided to date have been tangible. They have been real, and they have been appreciated. and they were not mandated, except by the fact that we have paid attention to the 2007 law and the flexibility that we think that law and prior work by the Governor's Task Force conveyed to allow us to look at those issues. We are skeptical about threshold numbers and requirements. They don't. They're sort of the one-size-fits-all kind of approach, and we're not sure that that's the best way to do this. We've had good success, we feel, with the local community, and we'd like to have that continued flexibility, you know, in the future. In summary, our experience to date has been both positive and reasonable. We expect local people and elected officials to be aware and concerned about benefits or lack of them. That's part of the process of getting a regulatory approval and a permit and citing something, and to the some of the other comments that have come in, it is very difficult to cite anything these days that produces energy. At the same time, we all want to plug into the wall outlet and make sure that you know, what we plug in actually operates and responds when we do that. But citing anything is difficult, and it should be. People should be aware of the impacts that projects have, and every ridge in the state of Maine or every mountaintop in the state of Maine is certainly not going to be a suitable place to put a wind turbine. But we think the process to date has worked for us. And as far as where this discussion goes from here, we're ready to work and to think about these issues. But I think hopefully the process has worked quite well to date, and the old adage is always, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and that's kind of the way we feel about the current situation. So with that, I'll conclude, and thank you very much, Senator and Representative.
Thank you very much. And, I think we have some questions. I'll go with Senator Sherman first, and Representative Van Wee second, and anyone else.
Thank you, Senator. I keep complaining I'm new to this committee, and still I haven't learned all the lingo of this, but looking, I have a question around the natural gas that flows through. We're looking at electrons flowing through and having some benefit of electrons flowing through. Is there some sort of assessment on the natural gas that flows through the pipeline that goes to the state of Maine?
There are several compressor stations in Maine, and there are several taps off in Maine. I can get the exact volumes. My impression the last time I looked at that was the PNJTS system was underutilized currently. We have usage in both Rumford and Jay, which have declined, and there have been some, it's less than full and less than robust is my impression, but I can also research that and get back to you.
What I'm getting at is that the oil refinery in Montreal is shutting down, I guess. So the other pipeline that goes to Montreal, does DEP get an assessment on all volatiles that are unloaded in Portland Harbor and goes north to Montreal? This is really what I'm looking at. The natural gas doesn't come from Maine. It's flowing through here. Is there any kind of assessment? Is there a tax? I don't want to call it a tax either, but it's does DEP have any assessment on the cubic footage that goes through that pipeline?
I don't know the answer to that, but I can find out.
Because that seems to me somewhat analogous to, like,
I do think there's an oil conveyance, some type of assessment.
So this is a natural gas pipeline, not an oil or pipeline.
Conveyance. You're talking natural gas or oil. My understanding is one on oil, which is, I shouldn't have thrown that in there, so I'm really asking about the natural gas pipeline.
I will find out. Thank you. Report back.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Van Wee, I think, has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for coming. I want to ask sort of the same question before, and reflecting a little bit on Representative Fitz's summation of our problem here, and I wonder if the wind power industry isn't being a little short-sighted in looking at kind of how this growing industry may continue over time to be accepted or not here in Maine, in that you're saying it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I'm trying to look 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, And here's the scenario that I think people are concerned about. And you mentioned this. I'd like you to kind of clarify how wind power really does lower rates, because this is sort of the perception of I think many average Mainers. Is okay, an outside developer comes in using financing from somewhere else, puts up the turbines, sells the power into the grid, bids at zero, gets natural gas clearing price, and what do we get? And does it really lower, how does that really lower our rates when we're still paying some of the highest rates in New England? And as long as those average people perceive it that way, at some point, they're going to not want more wind turbines because they're wondering how is that really benefiting Maine. And I think that the crux of Senator Mills' introductory remarks were right to that point. How is this industry, aside from construction jobs, which are enormous and a growing industry over the short term, but if people stop feeling that they're getting some tangible benefit from the marketplace greater than they're getting today, and there's a lot of issues. The New England ISO marketplace is a complex beast, but you folks are in a great position to sort of understand that. And I guess part of the question is, okay, if we don't do this, how do we respond to that concern that at some point Maine is covered with wind turbines, the power is being sold out of state, bid at zero, and we're still paying 16 cents a kilowatt hour here, and somebody else is cashing really big checks somewhere else. I think that's the crux of a little bit what I'm hearing in terms of and Representative Russell reflected on that as well, saying 2 or 3 years ago everybody was really gung-ho. Now that we're on our seventh and eighth large project, people are saying,
yeah.
Do we want to keep doing this? And so most of us around this table, for the reasons Representative Fitz mentioned, absolutely want to keep doing it. But we're trying to balance that. Right. And we don't want to end up having a revolt from the people who are helping us develop a resource that we think is necessary to run our economy. So can you help me out with that? I mean, I really don't understand how, you know, you sort of gloss through the well, we're selling into the grid and therefore we're lowering rates, and maybe that's one where we could start with.
Okay.
Let me
try a little bit here. I mean, when wind was developmental, let's say 5 to 10 years ago, the price per kilowatt hour for wind was much higher than it is today. For TransCanada, we're also a retail and wholesale power marketer, so we sell to customers, and each contract is fashioned based on the duration of the contract, the pricing at the time, our risk management and hedging strategies, and what we think the market will bear. But we're in a competitive power supply situation, and we do have customers in Maine. I think the fact that we have wind in our portfolio and hydro in our portfolio, and even though someone mentioned that there's no fuel costs to wind, there's certainly development costs to wind as there are to hydro, and the tangible benefits and the debt service and all the other things go into the fuel. In hydro, the relicensing costs that were mentioned earlier and the expectations out of licenses for things like fish passage and other things are part of that fuel cost. But for TransCanada, we think wind is definitely coming down in price, it's becoming more economic, and it's an attractive energy source for all the reasons that you've heard from a whole bunch of folks who testified this afternoon relative to climate change and carbon issues and other things. So we're not surprisingly bullish on it. We think it does lower prices for our customers, and we want to continue to develop wind in Maine and elsewhere. In terms of some of the really big picture questions that you asked, public policy questions, they're puzzling. I don't know how to solve all of those and to, you know, push down prices on things in a market situation. We compete in a market. We're not rate regulated, so all of our generation is essentially at risk. In 2008, for much of the year, we were, on an average, we were making about $100 a megawatt hour, even though the economy had started to turn south. In 2009, we made about $38 or $39 a megawatt hour energy clearing price across the board. So it's a very, you know, risky and difficult business, but it's one that we have worked hard to be successful in, and we hope to continue.
Yes, thank you very much for your comments. It's been a long afternoon. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you all. I'll just sign and the next witness or the testifier.
Thanks a lot. Safe trip.
Chairman Hobbins, Chairman Hink, members of the committee, I'm Dave Wilby with First Wind, based in Portland. I have provided some written testimony and materials that will be handed out. Given the hour and the way the committee likes to do business, I certainly won't be reading my testimony. I do want to just draw to your attention a few particular points. I'm happy to... answer any questions. I stand up here opposed to the bill as introduced, which I can hear Representative Van Lee or someone formulating, what do you think about the Diddishine proposal? We've had an opportunity to talk to Pete about that. I haven't had an opportunity to really think it through. There's some significant complexities, but we're going to engage in further conversations. Be happy to work with committee, Pete, and other key stakeholders going forward. The comments I will make, though, I would say are applicable to the bill as originally introduced, but also to Pete's bill or any other sort of proposal around tangible benefits. First Wind owns and operates the Marcel project, the Stetson project, including the expansion, the second phase of the Stetson project, which we are building, and by we I mean First Wind with Reed and Reed. Currently, we have offices, three offices around the state, and are trying to develop other projects beyond those I've mentioned. Fundamentally, First Wind has no objection to a requirement that new wind projects provide tangible benefits. The law currently requires that. Our projects provide, in our view, significant tangible benefits. A tangible benefit requirement, however, must be a balanced mechanism. To get to realize some tangible benefits, but in a way that also advances the state's sort of overarching goals of driving toward energy independence, toward fighting climate change, and toward economic growth, which I would include both economic growth and rates as a piece of that. I guess I would say the three sort of tests I would have for a tangible benefit idea, be it Senator Mills, Pete Diddishine, or anybody else, is it fairly predictable? Is it fair to the communities that are the hosts for these facilities? And finally, is it economically sustainable? You can ask a developer to provide outrageously large tangible benefits. That's not economically sustainable. So it has to be sustainable for all parties. I'm just going to raise sort of two concerns that were initially prompted by the Mills bill. I think they're issues I will still want to think through in the context of the Diddishine proposal. But first, let me just explain this, the timeline of how a project works. We go into permitting, which takes time, and really come out the other end of the permitting process, we hope, before financing occurs. The financing moment is after permitting. So if we require as part of permitting some sort of substantial economic give at the front end of permitting, and we don't really know the economics of the project until financing occurs after permitting is already ended, there's a sequencing issue here. Is it an insurmountable sequencing issue? perhaps not, but there is a sequencing issue. The greater the gap between the beginning of permitting and financing, the harder it is to drill down and do tangible benefits in a way that we know is sustainable and works for all parties. Part of the reason of that, and I'll just add sort of tangentially, is the expedited process that we hear so much about, either good or bad, has hit some snags. And those snags are really the appeals that are taking place in the court system, and frankly, the delays in the administrative process that's sort of a result of the appeal threat that's on the back end. In spite of the law, there are some sort of long delays right now, and I'll just cite our Rollins project. It's going to be a year and a half to 2 years. It probably could be over 2 years, in fact, from the date the permit is filed to the end of the permitting process. Now, if expedited means 2 years plus to you all, I mean, we may all have our definition of expedited. That's not my definition of expedited. So there's still some issues out there. It's not fast by any means. So the second issue I'll just raise is we have to be careful and think carefully about a one-size-fits-all approach to tangible benefits, both from the developer's perspective and the community and state's perspective. If we set a standard that's X, and a developer has a project that's a big project, great wind, great economics, that project may be able to bear X plus. We may also have a different project that's small, not very great wind, is okay economically, but not great, and we can't get anywhere near X. So in some cases, you may not get the tangible benefits that are really available. In other cases, you could kill a project because the project can't bear it. So that's just something we have to think about as we look at whatever one-size-fits-all ideas are out there. So just a couple quick. There's been a fair amount of discussion about existing tangible benefits. My testimony lays out some of that in detail. But just a couple quick snapshots, just four of them. Mars Hill, $10 million in property taxes over a 20-year period. Maybe that's not substantial to a state senator here, perhaps, but I can assure you, anybody wants to pick up the phone and call Ray Mercereau, the town manager in Mars Hill, and ask him if $10 million of new taxes over two decades is significant. He'll tell you that it is afforded a substantial property tax rate cut in his community. Stetson Project, they handed out the map. 130 main businesses were involved in the construction and development. $50 million spent in the main economy. Here's an important point, and I think it gets to questions that Representative Van Wee and others have asked about how rates can translate, how can we translate into rates. Part of the answer is this committee, some of you very individuals, have already established a mechanism for this. And it's the long-term contracting mechanism. And has been mentioned quickly by Senator Mills and others, under the terms of the PPA that was approved by the commission last fall, our Rollins project is going to sell all of its capacity and energy output for 20 years at a significant savings to the ratepayer. Our estimate is $30 to $40 million discount to the ratepayer. Now, it's important to note, I really vehemently disagree, I think, with Senator Mills on this point. He said that a lot of developers are not interested in selling to main consumers. That's just incorrect. This mechanism, this long-term contracting mechanism, is just now, the window is just now open for that in this past year. Rollins was the very first project. So all those other projects that came before until now, this was not an opportunity. This mechanism was not yet in place. It was in statute, but the rules hadn't worked their way through. The commission had not opened the window yet because they had work to do on it. So now that the window's open, you have a project done. You have other projects that are knocking on the door, and certainly from our perspective, we'd like to do more. So I would caution you not to assume that because one project and one project only from a wind perspective has done a long-term PPA, that's it. This is the first inning, and there's a lot more baseball to be played. I think with that, I will let you, at your own convenience, read testimony certainly will be here for a work session and available to answer questions now and between now and then. And thank you very much for your attention at this hour.
Thank you very much. Any questions at all, Mr. Wolby? Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to speak in opposition to this bill? Is there anyone else who wants to speak either for nor against? Good afternoon. I've been waiting a long time to speak for nor against.
Senator Hobbins, Representative Hink, distinguished members of the committee, my name is Gordon Mott. I'm from Lakeville, Maine. I'm speaking neither for nor against, and it's a clear validation right up front that I don't know enough to take a position one way or the other. Consider me to be relatively naive and uninformed and have the narrow view of these things, if you would. Together with my wife, Virginia, we're owners of prominent elevated property that may be eligible for future wind power development. Our home lies about 900 feet southeast downwind of the nearest candidate tower location. Wind power is in initial stages of evaluation, probable permitting and development within 3.7 miles in our view space. Our particular property is an icon in the view space of an extensive, dispersed, remote shorefront community in an area deeply valued over a long period of history for its natural character. We, personally, have long-term, deep conservation commitments. We have personal economic interests in this situation. We share with you a sense of social justice. These things are said by way of offering a sense of the balance from which the following views are offered. We see the private property rights issues. We see the green energy issues. We see the impact on visual environment issues. We see all sides of it from many points of view. We wrestle with the issue. I had not read this legislation until the past couple of days. I became familiar with it for the first time, saw the term tangible benefits, was delighted to find in the definition of tangible benefits the concept natural resource conservation. And then today, when Senator Mills introduced the statute, the door opened, in my perception, in that he used the word mitigation. Mitigation for the impact. That word is not in the statute. That concept has not been before us. And I basically wanted to speak to you on behalf of adding in the required tangible benefits that some resource be devoted to mitigating the impact on the natural character in the view space, and that those funds be dedicated to natural resource conservation as chosen in the affected host and other affected communities. That's basically what all of this language says, poorly, because it was written far too quickly. I would note, we live not far from Session Ridge development, testified there. Would note for you that we are an organized town in LIRC jurisdiction, and the development that is before us now is in Carroll Plantation, an organized community as well, under LIRC jurisdiction. on that when a discussion emerged about equating unorganized territory with county interests, I became very concerned that not be adopted as a concept of broad application. It's in my view that the impacts on the local affected communities, be they within LURC territory or out, be recognized to be limited in geographic area. And further, there's an equity issue in my mind in that in unorganized territory, the county looks after some roads. Vast territory up there is looked after by the expenditure of money to maintain roads by private property owners. And it would be far more appropriate and equitable in my mind if mitigation funding were dedicated to state costs for the unorganized territory. I would speak on behalf of LURC. Some would not, but I have the highest regard for the difficult role that they play in unorganized territory. They are our planning, zoning, permitting entity. They deserve far better support than they've had. Funding should go there rather than to the county, perhaps to look after municipal solid waste problems in various places. The game wardens are indeed a significant part of the police force. Our natural resource values, our deer yards, all of these things need to be supported. So money that might come to the state that could support Inland Fisheries and Wildlife Department, LURC, and so forth, would be an equitable use of any funding to mitigate for the natural resource impacts in my mind. I offer you that view. And in conclusion, I would make a particular plea to the Natural Resources Council of Maine that they do everything they can to elevate the stature of natural resource conservation in any revisions that are made to the statute, and make that a necessary bit of mitigation that needs to be done.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is there a question? Yes. I think we have one from Representative Adams.
Chairman and Mr. Mott, I want to make sure that I did get accurately down the statement you had made about what you felt deeply should be the second purpose of mitigation. But first, I did want to also tell you that though your category came up last, by no means is one of the few real civilians in the room that we think of you as coming up last. And several of us on this panel had the distinction and honor and obligation of serving on the Wind Energy Task Force of a couple of years ago, putting together without many guides how best to handle this in Maine through a stakeholders group report to us. Many axes ground in the group, and maybe some around the table with us too. But there was no guarantee we got it right, absolutely right. And I would think you'd find on either side of the table, setting everything else aside, our feeling was that, you know, we got to learn, experiment. We'd like it to be on our terms, because after all, it's our state, setting aside all these others. So though you come up last year, in no way last in our regard. And I wanted to, that preamble, to ask if you would repeat your second point about mitigation. I was trying to write as fast as I could, but in it you brought up many ingredients: LURC, road maintenance, deer yards, inland fish, etc. And I would like it if you could state it again so that I get it and I understand it, at least for me and maybe for some of us.
In my mind, the span of elements, the span of expenditures, and the focus of expenditures for natural resource conservation to mitigate should be under the discretion of the impacted communities, the affected communities, decisions made on a local basis. Stetson Ridge, for example, there was a $100,000 fund, one-time payment made, the Forest Trust of Maine, for for conservation activities was in the Muskogee watershed. There's a much bigger area than that impacted. But at least there is a mechanism in place for local decision-making to be made. In our particular area, in my testimony, I mentioned that we need to purchase access to great ponds that we don't have access to now. There are no public sand beaches. There are sand beaches. We could use them in the region if we could purchase them. Easements are needed to purchase, protect, maintain, and preserve deer wintering habitat. There are some old-growth forest fragments that deserve preservation. Corridors for public trails and public green space for the building of our future communities. What we do on our watch at this time in that regard will have profound effects. Maybe we'll have a central park in the middle of downtown Lincoln. It's the concept is that local decisions along that path would be the right way to do it. And there are models for local governance of that kind that have already been put out, I would note, by State Planning Office for the establishment of education foundations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak in opposition to this? I'm sorry, I apologize. You need a for or against.
No.
That's a better category. Sorry for the long delay. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Senator Hobbins, members of the committee. My name is Dan Fitzgerald. I'm here on behalf of Horizon Wind Energy, which is a partner in Aroostook Wind Energy. We have several wind energy developments that we are working on throughout Aroostook County. Originally, we were coming to speak in opposition of the original bill, and many of the points that we had on that have already been shared here tonight. Since then, there's been an amendment to the bill proposed, and I'd like to speak on that. I haven't had a great deal of time to review the information on that. I'm originally from New York State. I'm not used to things moving this swiftly with the legislative body. So, it all comes down to tangible benefits. And some important points I'd like to make. As I said, we're neither for nor against the amended bill right now. We need further time to review it. Some things came up with it, though. The fact that it has a set price in it. Each project, each township, each area of the unorganized territories is unique. And to set a specific price for that area seems that it could be wrong for the area and for the project. As was stated before, each project is unique. The costs are very different. We could have something that has a 3-mile transmission line or a 50-mile transmission line. Greatly changes the economics of the project. Additionally, we have very different townships that we work in. One of the areas that we're working in right now is in the unorganized territory, adjacent to Bridgewater. You know, we talk about jobs, and it's been said, well, construction-wise, we've seen a great number of jobs come in, and then that's a temporary thing. Well, we look at putting our operations center in Bridgewater, which the last town meeting they announced they have a population of 622. So if we bring 12 jobs to that town, that's a significant number in that town. Some other things that came up, and I got to listen to everybody else, so had the wheels turning the whole time. We talked about tangible benefits. You know, are they leaving town? Are they going to the turbine manufacturers? Are they going just to the temporary construction? An important part of this is that we pay leases on the land that we use for these turbines. And in our developments right now, we primarily have two types of landowners, those in the timber industry and those in agriculture. And let me tell you, right now with both those industries, it is important for them to know that they have guaranteed income every year, to know that there's going to be a steady amount coming in. It helps them with the banks. It helps them with future growth. They can plan better. They know that they're going to be there next year to plan for when times get better. Some questions came up about the prices of electricity. And yes, I would love to say that we are going to provide the state of Maine with cheaper electrical rates. Some things about that. First of all, the fact that we do not have a variation in our fuel costs should allow us to give a steady price. The fact that it's a new competitive piece of the electrical grid, there will be competition between us and other suppliers of power. Economics tells you that should work. However, as we've seen in recent years, economics is not exactly predictable. And for us to state that one of our projects that is but a small piece of the electrical generation in the state is going to push those rates down, guaranteed, would be very difficult for us to guarantee and base our economics on that. Now, the idea of the power purchase agreements, the 20-year power purchase agreements being worked with the PUC, that is a wonderful way to regulate that. It gives us something that we can be sure of, as well as you something that you can be sure of, as well as the ratepayer something they can be sure of. So that is a wonderful way in which to deal with ensuring power prices. I'd just like to close with saying we need our projects to be environmentally feasible, electrically feasible, and economically feasible for us to build them. And with the expedited laws, expedited siting law here in Maine, that's very possible for us. Electrically, there's some challenges in the state, I'll admit to that. And economically, right now, it does work. And we worry that any change to law could affect that and take that out of the equation as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions at all from members of the committee? Thank you very much, and thank you for waiting.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak neither for nor against this legislation? Hearing none, we'll declare the public hearing closed and take it up at our next work session. Oops. Okay. One other. Just reopen for one second. That's be quick.
Oh, just very quick. Senator Hobbins, members of the committee, I'm Paulina Collins with the PUC. Our testimony was drafted on the bill as printed.
Yes.
And we had respectfully offered a suggestion for clarifying the language in terms of the benefit to ratepayers in reducing the long-term electric rates.
Yes.
We haven't had a full opportunity to review the revised language, and I'd just like to offer that we might have additional comments
for like
the work session.
Anything you want to do, come to our work session next week. We'd be happy to have you. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Any other comments before we close the public hearing and quickly go on to the next matter? Thank you.
Last but not least, we are very pleased to have LD 1581 presented, an act to concerning electricity customers whose bills increase as a result of the implementation of energy conservation or energy efficiency measures, and we're pleased to have Representative Fitz and our colleague present the bill.
Thank you, Chairman Hobbins, and I didn't write the title, so I don't take any ownership in that at all. Senator Hobbins and what's left of the Utilities and Energy Committee, I am Stacy Fitz, represent House District 29, which and live in Pittsfield. And as you heard, I'm here to present LD 1581, and I'm not going to go through all of my written testimony, which has been passed out or will be being passed out. But in a nutshell, I had a constituent who happens to also be a business partner in something not related to this issue, and he brought to me a situation. He owns a grocery store, happens to be in Heartland, and as equipment has failed in his business, things like refrigeration compressors and items such as that, he's replaced with what he would hope to be the more efficient model. You know, when a piece of equipment fails and you're given a choice between the cheaper one that will get you by or the more expensive one that everybody says will save you money, well, he typically would try to go with the more expensive one because, in his mind, that would make more sense long term. Well, as it turns out, when he started to replace equipment over time, he originally had a peak kilowatt hour or kilowatt load of 20 kilowatts, which put him in the above the medium general service line. And as time has gone on, he's drifted back and forth over that line. And the result is that he eventually wound up at a point where CMP shifted him from medium general service to small general service. Now, medium general service, and I actually have a copy of his electric bills that Kristen has available that can kind of go down the line. I didn't want to hand them out to everybody because they are his electric bills. But I also have done a spreadsheet analysis of what's pretty much in those bills. And medium general service is a type of electric service rate that is more based on demand. And so you build at a higher level for your demand and a lesser level for your kilowatt hour usage. But if you get shifted to a small general service, the reverse is true. There's no demand charge, but your kilowatt hour usage drives your bill, and your kilowatt hour rate is higher. So as it turns out, when you run the numbers, he wound up paying a little over $273 from 1 month to the next, more on a bill that actually had fewer kilowatt hours of usage. And it just happens to be that it's because of that shift from medium general to small general service. Well, in a nutshell, he wasn't very happy. And he came to me, and as this electric bill goes by, you'll see there's a note on the bottom, and it says, "Stacy, check this out. I used less electricity than the month before, and my bill was $273.28 more. It sure pays to be energy efficient." Well, I would agree. It should pay to be energy efficient. In this case, it wasn't. And for several folks across the state, as it turns out, this is in fact the case. So it just jumped out at me that this was a problem, and so I contacted the public advocate's office and raised the question, and he did a little research and found out that this was in fact not a unique situation. In fact, Representative Webster's here, and Senator Grzowski, who share a constituent, and they also had this problem
which we'll hear about in a few minutes. But we contacted Central Maine Power, the Public Advocates Office did. We've had a few conference calls and meetings and thought maybe we could administratively deal with this, because there used to be a policy that the utility would give the best rate. If it was better for you to be in a small general, you'd stay small general. If it was better to be medium general, you'd be there. Well, they stopped doing that. And they were kind of unmoving in the discussion. They at least talked, but we didn't ever get to a resolution. And as a result, the Public Utilities Commission has opened a docket on this, an investigation, to see how widespread it is, to see, you know, what are solutions. And it's basically the way it's come to pass, and I appreciate the public advocate taking the lead on this and getting the administration involved. And I think sometimes in order to set a policy statement, we need to sometimes act as a legislature to get the message across. And so that is why this bill is in front of us. Now, is the language perfect? It's been vetted a few different ways. We may hear suggestions on how it could be made better, how it might be made worse. I think we can wordsmith this in work session and hopefully come up with something that does work for the majority. But I don't think it behooves us to not act. I think we need to send a message that if people are making those choices and buying the most expensive of the two, and then find over time that those efforts wind up costing them $273 from one month to the next, we might want to reconsider that the policies that we're trying to promote aren't being implemented in a proper way, and we're being kind of resisted within the industry. So that's the bill. I think we'll hear from the public advocate and others that there are more instances of this, and I think it deserves our attention. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Fletcher has a delta.
I knew it was a bad idea to give Ken numbers.
Question. Thank you very much. Representative Fitz, the gist, very quick question, and if I look at the spreadsheet, that $273 is made up of two things, 114 shift in the price of electricity.
Correct.
And then the other is the T&D charge.
That's right.
So it's not just electricity. It's a combination of those two coming together at a higher price.
And I would add that when one is moved from small general to medium general and vice versa, those tend to follow. And since this and these electric bills were brought forward, he has moved to a different supplier, and he's moved off standard offer and has some understanding with his supplier that he would get the better rate.
But
that's just on the electricity
portion.
That's
just the electricity.
No matter what happens on that portion, the delivery side is really the side that Central Maine Power has control over. And related to the spreadsheet, I tried to run the numbers both on the month-to-month that he'd given me for electric bills, but then I did a hypothetical and said, well, what if in the first month he had been in the small general as a result? And that's what the lower of the two in the analysis is. And you can see that from comparing apples to apples on the 5-20-209 bill, that his bill would have been $205 more just on delivery for that portion, if on an equal basis for those months. So
if we think of it another way, if we can rectify the situation, and we'll assume that that's $273 a month more, if we get that corrected for that supplier, he would then have $3,000 approximately available every year to keep investing in energy efficiency.
That's right.
And we wouldn't have to give Efficiency Maine grants.
And I would add, he did this without grants.
Right. No, but I'm just saying, if you think about the logic of what this does to people, it says, well, now I got to have a grant.
I would add one more, that the logic that it does for people is if being above the 20 kilowatt load line is the line of demarcation, and you found yourself at 18, and your only option was to add another cooler, even though you really didn't need one, we'd have customers out there adding things just for the sake of getting their electric bill into a new rate class. That
probably
is,
save money.
And actually, they would be cheaper. Probably their monthly bill would be lower. So I don't know what we're incentivizing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything else? Thank you very much.